Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influences their own work or something that haunts them at night. And today, I'm really excited to have actor and entrepreneur Jeanette Goldstein here with me. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, April.
For those of you who would like an introduction fully to Jeanette, please let me give a This Is Your Life of her life. Jeanette Goldstein was born and raised in Los Angeles and knew when she was a kid that she wanted to become a character actor. To live that dream, she trained at Circle in the Square in New York and Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Art in London. It was in London where she auditioned for a scrappy horror sequel called Aliens, directed by James Cameron. Her role as Private Vasquez soon became an instant icon. Along with her Aliens castmate Bill Paxton, Jeanette also moved to a different Cameron-affiliated horror film at the same time, starring as Vampire Diamondback in Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark, which our listeners will remember Karin Kusama talked about on her episode early in the show's incarnation. Mm-hmm. She then hit another couple of Cameron properties, playing the Terminator-infected foster mom Janelle Voight in Terminator 2 and the doomed Irish mother in Titanic. But some may also remember her as Alice the Maid in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, or from any other supporting role that she's been blessing our screens with. She has exploded many times and often goes down with the ship. Somewhere in her busy career, Jeanette also became co-founder and CEO of Jeanette Bras, LA County's best bra fitting and swimwear boutiques, where, quote, the alphabet starts at D. Jeanette Bras is opening its fourth and fifth stores in Burbank in February and Atlanta in March, and that Burbank one just opened. Jeanette lives with her artist husband and changing cast of children and cats in Virgil Village. So, Jeanette, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Mandy. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Oh, my God. It just kind of instinctually sort of popped up. I guess it, I don't know, I have a lot, but you had already done some. But it's so crazy. It goes beyond crazy, and it's beautiful. It's an incredible love story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, genre is this kind of odd term for something really simple and pure. And mm-hmm. I like the word scrappily made, mm-hmm. you know, like we have an ATV vehicle. Let's write it in. You know, there's a yeah. something. It's wild. It's crazy. It's violent. And it's tragic. And
yeah.
And I'd never seen anything like that before, and yet kind of felt like I'd seen it all before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like a complete repackaging of these kind of visceral feelings or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that raw sort of, you know, the scream of, you know, of loss. And it just keeps, you think it's gone far enough, and it just goes over, keeps going.
That's
Nicolas Cage for you.
Yes. For those of you who haven't seen Mandy, today's episode will obviously give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch, as always. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to watch Mandy first, this is your shot. And now let me introduce Mandy with a quick synopsis, as quick as I can possibly be for this very complex film that is also quite simple. Written by Aaron Stewart Ahn and Panos Cosmatos and directed by Cosmatos for release in 2018, Mandy stars Andrea Riseborough as Mandy and Nicolas Cage as Red, two quiet, star-crossed metalheads living in the woods in 1983. We watch them live out their idyllic existence, Mandy drawing elaborate and beautiful fantasy art that Red adores. Red working as a lumberjack and returning home on the twisty roads to the remote home. It's pretty nice. They watch TV and talk, both seemingly broken people who found one another and healed. One night, Mandy recounts a tragic story from her childhood about some starlings. Red simply listens.
My dad came walking across with a pillowcase and a crowbar. And there was something, you know, moving around inside of the pillowcase, like squirming around. And he said, we should gather around. He had something to show us. And so we all gathered around. And he emptied what was in the pillowcase on the ground. And it was a bunch of baby starlings. And he told us that he was going to show us how to kill them.
One day, Mandy heads to her cashier job at a gas station and convenience store and passes by a van carrying the children of a New Dawn hippie cult. Their leader, Jeremiah Sands, decides he wants his follower, Brother Swan, to kidnap Mandy. There's just something about her.
I need you to get me that girl I saw. I need her. I need her now.
Swan goes out in the van with a few other followers to call forth the Black Skulls, a demonic, cannibalistic biker gang fueled by some bad LSD, and they offer up one of their own as a sacrifice so these dudes can help them take Mandy. After, the cult goes to Mandy and Red's home, subdues Red, and drugs Mandy to offer her up to Sands. He tries to seduce her with his folk music, but she simply laughs him into oblivion.
Shut up!
As retribution, Sands burns Mandy alive in front of Red, who survives a stabbing and grieves wildly in the bathroom before recouping for wild, unhinged revenge the next day. Red visits his friend Carruthers to get his crossbow, Carruthers played by Bill Duke, the legend, which he calls the Reaper. Carruthers tells him this hippie gang is backed by the Black Skulls and to be careful.
When I seen them things, they were in a world of pain. But you know what the freakiest part was?
What's that?
They fucking loved it.
So Red goes home and forges a battle axe, of course. He tracks the biker gang, but is caught and brought to their hideout. He breaks free and manages to kill the whole gang while also digesting some of their jacked up LSD, turning him into a hallucinating feral animal. A man named the Chemist tells him where to find Sands in a church, so he goes there and kills a couple of the brothers, one through seriously mental chainsaw battle. Red beheads Sister Lucy then and rolls her severed head out to Sands, who, without his little army, is a sad, pathetic man begging for mercy.
Oh, I'll blow you, man. I'll suck your fucking dick. Is that what you want out of me?
Red kills him and sets his church on fire, then drives away in the dark, imagining the spirit of Mandy beside him.
It's just your average love story.
Yeah, it's just, you know, star-crossed lovers.
It's so good.
The first thing, you know, connecting this back to your youth in L.A., you said, you know, in your bio that you wanted to be a character actor since you were young. And I wanted to share a quote with you from Andrea Riseborough, who is, you know, showing herself to be a bit of a chameleon herself in her career early. And she said, "I don't relate to people that look like me. I find it deeply unsatisfying to play a version of myself. It was something I had to figure out really early on when I was at Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts because I was being cast over and over again as the young virginal thing. When I left RADA, I was on absolute mission to never wear makeup. I never, ever wanted to get anything based on how I looked. I managed to slip through somehow, and I think perhaps only now people are starting to realize I might not be so asymmetrical. But it was really difficult to negotiate that path because at every turn as a female actor, people want to compartmentalize you so that they don't feel uncomfortable. They don't want to feel threatened. Transformation as a female actor is allowed up to a certain extent, as long as they can still recognize you on a red carpet. And for a woman to be a shapeshifter and to be that malleable in spirit is really not okay with the patriarchy."
Interesting.
I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, because when she was looking at the script, and, you know, this is a character that's very different. She also in that year released The Death of Stalin, and she's playing a very kind of like clear-faced, like blonde, hysterical woman who's like the exact opposite of the character that she's playing in this, like literal polar opposites. And a lot of people didn't even know it was the same actor. And I think that that's might be kind of a difficult thing to try to set yourself up as being a chameleon if you want to be a character actor.
It's difficult. Well, it's the thing. I mean, why should somebody recognize you from role to role? I mean, I always thought, well, isn't that the idea? You know, that's the target. But as as a career, it's difficult when people don't know who you are, because they always, they, you know, like I guess she was saying, you know, she says to the patriarchy, you know, who are you? What do you do? Mm-hmm. Let me put you into a box and so I can feel safe and you can do it again. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's interesting when I saw, I didn't know who she was. I didn't know the name. I didn't know the actress. And so it's great when you have no idea. And I immediately, you know, IMDb'd her to see who she was. You know, mm-hmm. Oh, she's English, you know. And I know she's also, isn't she a writer and a director as well?
Yeah. She's been producing stuff. She produced a movie called Nancy, who mm-hmm. Christina Cho, who was on the show last year, the year before, directed. So she's got her hand in a lot of different things, I think, which is maybe helpful in controlling that kind of narrative about yourself.
It's great. I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't know. I never could play the young ingenue. I mean, the way I looked was always, I never, like she said, I don't run into people who look like me mm-hmm. in a way. So I've always felt like, well, I kind of look like this little animal as a little kid. And even as a young girl, I knew I was never the ingenue, mm-hmm. Which is great, because acting for me is like putting on masks and pretending to be other people. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's like, I don't know, it would be weird to sort of be myself.
To be yourself.
I mean, I'm myself all, you know, all day long. Who wants to, you know, be paid for that?
Getting bored with that bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. Once I figure out who she is, I'll let you know.
Someday someone will write you a script that's about a bra entrepreneur.
Right. And they'll never
lead role.
Yeah, exactly.
They'd be like, I don't want to play that. So on taking this role, Andrea said also, because this was not something that most people expected her to take. It was very different from obviously what she was doing. And she said, I was sent the script and, to be honest, I had never anticipated doing a Nick Cage movie. It wasn't something that looked like it might be on my horizon. He's such a great person to work with and so professional and kind and cool. But for me, it felt like a left field choice. I read the script and it was so wonderful, insane, and beautifully written. It took me about 2 minutes, though, to say yes. And you cannot even imagine how insane it's going to be. And we, now that we've seen the movie, yes, we can.
As an actor and also as an audience member, I was like, wow, what, you know, how did she come to the film? How did everybody come to the film? And mm-hmm. I mean, that's the great thing about independent film and grindhouse is that you don't recognize mm-hmm. usually, or you don't recognize them, or there's the guy you always know, like Bill Duke. You're like, yes, of course.
Yeah, when Bill Duke shows up, you're like,
yeah, well, then
of course.
Yeah, so you see the same person over and over who repeats for the director. I mean, that's part of what you know, grindhouse is. There's a certain amount of actors that appear, and then there's the ones that, you know, they're not actors at all, and that's kind of part of the fun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, talking about actors that appear, like, you were, you know, like, you were kind of a staple of the Cameron mm-hmm. stable, you know, beginning kind of early in your career. So you were kind of shuffled into different roles with a lot of the same people, it seemed like.
Well, he gave me my first film job. So I'd never been on camera or done TV or anything. And so he had taken a chance on me. And from there, how I had ended up in Kathryn Bigelow's film in Near Dark was because they had been working together and he was mentoring her mm-hmm. and the script. And I had come back to the States and I didn't have an agent, not an American agent. And Kathryn couldn't find me and Jim knew my mother's phone number. And so it was like that. I just got a phone call. I was like, hey, you know, can I send you, you know. It was so funny. It was like that. And that's how I got the script and then how Bill and Lance and I kind of ended up together. That was almost kind of coincidental in a weird way. But it did come from the connection through Cameron.
Yeah, I would assume that just like, okay, I've worked with these people who are very amazing, have really like kinetic energy, good mm-hmm. faces, like, yes, of course, I would like to use them, you know?
Yeah, you already have a history. We'd known each other for, you know, for the longest time, and then you're supposed to be a family that's lived, you know, an eternity together. It helps.
Yes. I was actually looking for any kind of interview with Panos Cosmatos where he could talk about why he offered the script to Andrea Riseborough, but that was the one thing I couldn't find.
Where he'd seen her and where...
Yeah, like what exactly it was that drew him to her. I don't know exactly what that is. Maybe we'll find it. Maybe I can ask him at some point.
Her face is amazing.
Eyes, like the big kind of watery, big...
Massive. Yeah, I was looking. And then I was fascinated with that scar, that jagged scar that mm-hmm. never was explained, and I was so glad it was never I love that. I mean, and I wondered, did she, as an actress, say, I want a scar, or, I mean, I her process. I mean, I
totally.
Love, I love that, and I like the fact that you don't know. I mean, if people yeah. say, you know, hints at something darker. I mean, my mind was like, ooh, that looks like she went through a windshield. You know, that yeah. kind of thing. And it hints at a, you know, a darker, obviously she'd gone through something. But
yeah.
I was like, why not? Why not have a scar and not no one say anything?
Have you done that for any of your roles where you kind of suggest like a weird kind of charm in a sense that's like unexplained
oh, yeah.
that's on your character? Like for what? What well,
do you... it was for Vasquez. I had, I don't even think it was ever in a shot. I had a tattoo on my inner forearm that said Inez.
Oh, and it would be never explained, but that was...
You know, I didn't even know if it was in a shot or, you know, we got to personalize our lockers and our clothing and things like that and for ourselves. And that was the name for me. That was my daughter. That was a kid I had, you know. But it didn't, you know, people have things. You don't explain. You don't walk up to say, hello, so you see this shirt that I'm wearing. Let yeah. me give you some exposition about this T-shirt and how I got, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break and we'll come right back. We'll talk about Johan and then we'll also talk about a little bit more of the intimacy that Jeanette was bringing up and some of the processes that Nick Cage went through to get to those emotional places in this film. So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Hill from Before, and I'm very excited to bring Dave Hill's podcasting incident back to Maximum Fun, where it belongs. You can get brand new episodes every Friday on MaximumFun.org, or, you know, wherever. And while my partner Chris Gersbeck and I might lack in specific subject matter on our podcast, we make up for in special effects. Chris, add something cool right here. Also, we have explosions, animal noises, and sometimes even this. Dave Hill's podcasting incident, every Friday on Maximum Fun. Chris, do another explosion right here.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jeanette Goldstein, and we're talking about Mandy. So before the break, Jeanette had mentioned the score, and Johansson did a really fantastic score for this movie. And, you know, he had done other kind of higher profile, more, almost Oscar-ish movies, you know. And then this one came along, and it turned out that Panos Cosmatos did not have him in the running for score whatsoever. And that was because he seemed like he would be kind of too classic, too perfect, you know, and he wanted something that was a little bit metal in this. And it turned out that Johan Johansson was a metalhead. Panos said, I didn't have him in mind. I didn't immediately think of him as an option. But it turned out that he had seen Black Rainbow, which was Panos's previous film, and wanted to work with me, much to my surprise. But after talking to him for a bit, he's a sensitive guy, but he's also, I started to realize, an Icelandic metalhead. He has this whole other side of him that he wanted to express that he hadn't really done before in a score, and that excited me as well. So, you know, very sad Johan died. Love that he was able to express another side of himself in this project before that ultimately happened. And I think that that must be like such a hard thing, you know, that comes up a lot in the show. Kind of being pigeonholed for what you are good at and what you are so clearly excelling at, but then having this other personal side of yourself that you don't really get to express all the time.
Yeah, well, I've always found, yeah, the creative people will recognize creativity in the individual, and they'll know that they can create in a different genre, or they don't pigeonhole. I mean, I've always been amazed at the roles that I've gotten where the director just goes, I know you can do it. It's not like prove it to me.
Oh, okay.
It's like I've seen, you know, I know, and I get the fact that you can recognize someone who's like really creative and they don't have to do the same thing. Nobody wants to do the same thing over and over.
I mean, it gets boring. Well, some people want to.
for a while, and then
But yeah, you get bored. I wanted to talk a little bit about Nicolas Cage's coming to Red, his character Red, specifically because it was kind of a blank slate for him on the script. He said, quote, "I came to Mandy more from the perspective of it being a script and a filmmaker that could create a world unlike anything else I'd ever done. But I'm excited by it and I'm very enthusiastic about it. But also, the Red character is a vessel where I can, I believe, conjure up the emotional content necessary, whether it be through my life experience or my dreams or my imagination, to play the part authentically." He saw it as kind of this blank slate where he could really put himself into it. So there was, you know, a kind of slimmer outline of who this character could be.
Right. Well, it's funny because I was I read an interview where actually Panos was thinking of him as the
Jeremiah Sands.
And he said, no, it's Red I want to play, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so interesting because, of course, you think, oh, you know, Nick Cage, the villain and the crazy, whacked out.
Absolutely,
you know, and Linus Roach was incredible.
Yes.
And but the fact that you take a person with all his life experience and the history and the way he looks and you put him as the male, the lead, the lover, the you know, the usual, you know, pretty boy, nice body, you know, all that kind of cliche that you would think, but you go, no, he's have him, he doesn't have to do as much. I mean, and that's a weird thing to say about Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, right.
He was very minimalist. But in a way, you didn't have to, there was no backstory about, you know, was he an alcoholic? I mean, everything was there because it was Nick Cage.
Yeah.
And it was really, I thought it was great to see how he does the leading man.
Yeah. I wanted to get into the fact that Nicolas Cage also came from smaller independent films, too. And that kind of fuels his choices and has fueled his choices throughout a lot of his career, because he would do big movies and keep going back to doing independent films and then big movies and never quite did just one. But he said, quote, "I came out of independently spirited movies, and I think that in many ways they are the pictures that have created the most original opportunities for me. The higher up you go in the scale of costs, the more difficult it is to make a movie that's an original movie. I think that when the cost of a film is under control, like Mandy, there are fewer cooks in the kitchen telling the director what to do. There's more oxygen in the room with which to be creative, and the actors and the director can be more collaborative. And that's what's happened with Mandy."
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, the more money that's at stake and the more suits come to visit the set and the more, you know, it's just everyone is just scared and, oh, my God, I'm going to make a mistake. And, you know.
I mean, do you feel like you've been able to give, like, your best performance for bigger budget things, or do you feel like sometimes that's hindered?
I'm trying to think of it. I don't know. I haven't really been in any very large. I mean, if you think about Aliens, I mean, the budget
was scrappy.
$16 million. That was it. It was a low budget film. It was a Corman film. I mean, we had a joke where anything that broke, we just gaffer taped it. It was a low budget, you know, and they thought, oh, we're going to shut the set down. And he was like, no, we'll fix it. We'll fix it. We'll just gaffer. That, it was like being on a Corman film. I mean, I know like a horror film that I did, and they tried to get this film that was called Autopsy. And I get my arm cut off at the end.
Yeah.
And there's this big scene with the final girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this whole prosthetic and the thing and the blood, and they tried to get it at the end. All I did was just tuck my arm underneath. I just tucked it under. And I was like, and it worked fantastic.
Well, I mean, speaking of arms, I mean, like Terminator 2, like that had to be a really weird experience. You know, like it was a level up of budget.
Definitely.
From what you guys had. Mm-hmm. And then you're doing some pretty complex VFX at that time too, and then part of that was your arm.
This was like the first kind of visual effects. I mean, for me, all I had to do, they had to stick my arm in goop and make, you know, a fake arm of it, and then I just had to put my arm behind my back.
A lifetime of putting your arm behind your back tonight.
Exactly. And then somebody told me what I was doing, like, you know, move your eyes here, move your eyes there, move your eyes here, move your eyes there, and then, you know, I see it as an audience member, I finally see what the computer's doing.
Oh, I like that. That's funny. But it has to be a lot of trust on that set in that time, because that, I mean, like, T2 blew up a lot of rules with VFX. There's no doubt about it. So
I, you know, they, when Dennis came to me and it would kind of tried to explain to me what was going to happen, things were going to melt, and then the computer, you know, you're just like, okay, yeah, sure. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. I would love to talk about your version, or how you define success when you come to roles and when you see like a final product in a film, like when you see yourself in T2 and you're like, okay, I did what I was supposed to do. This is my success. In regards to Nicolas Cage and him defining his own success in movies, like whether or not he thinks he did well in the role, he said, quote, "The question I ask myself is, did I achieve and realize my dreams that I had hoped for with my performance? With Mandy, I would say absolutely yes. I think that Panos and I guided a character that I think was very satisfying, but more importantly, I'm excited that an audience member, a film enthusiast, is going to get in step with it and go along for the ride. For me, that is the ultimate response, to be in a theater and to get that 42nd Street in 1975 feeling where people were catcalling at the theater at midnight. They're freaking out. I love that kind of response. And to me, the bar for success is if you get an audience going." And he's coming to this as like not an actor who worked on the stage too, which to me seems more like something that an actor who works on the stage would want to have that immediate feedback or know how to play to an audience, you know, specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I my idea of success is, it has, because I come from the stage, is, you know, does it work with the story? Am I telling the story?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, you know, like, it's less about me and what I've achieved, is does it move the story along and you believe what's going on? And then, but going to see it, of course, it's the audience. I mean, I love going to see it, like he said, on 42nd Street, going to see it with an audience. Because if you don't get the reaction from the audience, you mean, you're a storyteller, the person listening to it is the reason you're doing it. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter how you feel about it. I mean, I've had some of my worst takes or worst performance, like, ugh, was so bad. And then somebody will come up to you and just be like, that was the most, it made me think of this and feel this. And that's why you're doing it.
And you're like, oh shit, it doesn't matter what I
think.
Well,
yeah, you don't. Yeah, exactly. And that's why you would never say anything about, yeah, you know, how you felt.
Zipped lips.
Sometimes you feel spectacular and it's just a total mess. There's the opposite too, right? So
I mean, yeah, you don't really know how it's going to turn out or what's going to, again, it's trusting that director, like Nicolas Cage, being like, well, I saw his last movie and I know that,
yeah,
he can do this. He can accomplish this. So,
seeing the director's film, the last film, is really important, and trusting the director, because, you know, that's the final say, the control.
Be honest, did you immediately trust James Cameron to make Aliens?
You know, I saw Terminator. I saw it like the night before I went in for the first meeting, and mm-hmm. I didn't even know what film I was going in for, and met Gail Ann Hurd, and I didn't know who she was. You know, she was 29, mm-hmm. I think. Oh my God. In this office, and there was a poster of Terminator, and I went, oh my God, I love that movie. She goes, oh, that's ours. And I thought she'd put it up like on her bedroom. I didn't realize, and I was like,
oh, it's like one of my favorites. Yeah, where I'm such a big fan too. Let's girl out about it.
I was so stupid. But oh God, I loved it. I loved that movie. I mean, again, it was just an incredible love story, and so I was very excited because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'd seen, well, that was the only movie. I did not see Piranha 2, so I had nothing.
I had.
You had seen Piranha 2? Maybe I would not have.
I'm glad that you chose to see Terminator, though, instead of Piranha 2. But either way,
yeah,
I don't know. I think Piranha 2 is pretty great with what he had. So
okay.
You can trust me, unless you've seen it since.
I haven't.
Oh, well, now you've got some weekend viewing plans, Jeanette.
I know.
I would love to take a break. When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about process, and I swear to God, we're going to get to that bathroom scene, because I feel like people who are listening are like, let's talk about the bathroom scene. And there is quite a bit that went into that, because it's very pivotal in terms of holding the story together. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll come right back.
Hey, J. Keith.
Hey, Helen. I hear you have a true-false quiz you want me to finish.
I do. Here we begin. We host a trivia game show podcast on the Max Fun Network called Go Fact Yourself.
True.
Correct. The show is all about celebrity guests answering trivia questions about things J. Keith enjoys.
False. We sometimes don't talk about baseball or cats.
Thank God. It's questions about things they enjoy. Next, we bring on surprise experts every episode.
True.
Correct. Final question. It's just the two of us sitting alone with these guests.
False.
Correct. We have a live audience at the Angel City Brewery. See? You can hear Go Fact Yourself every first and third Friday of the month. And if you don't listen, you can go fact yourself.
True.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jeanette Goldstein, and we're talking about Mandy. So I'm going to begin with a story about a happy accident that happened on set. And it is in that bathroom scene, because if viewers will remember when they saw it, that it was a long kind of static scene, or not static, it was a slow push-in, actually. So they were on rails and they were pushing the camera in very slowly while Nicolas Cage is feeling grief and freaking out and trying to figure out what he's going to do. And so Panos Cosmatos said, quote, he did one take, and then I gave him some notes and modulation on where I want to transition rather quickly, and he did it again, and it was magical. But in that scene, in that shot, when he was actually pulling the towels out of the drawer, he accidentally threw the towel onto the dolly track, and so we were dollying forward, and the dolly got caught on the towel, and we realized it pretty quickly, and we reached out and pulled it out of the way. But you can actually feel the dolly stopping as it stops on the towel. But I ended up only being able to take so much to the site, and it was kind of beautiful. And apparently, like in that shot, because they used the second one where the towel landed on the dolly, there is a kind of
jerk.
Oh. Like a really minimal jerk that worked with the emotional tone of the story that they ended up keeping it. The funny thing, though, is that Nicolas Cage doesn't like happy accidents. He's a very prepared person, which is something that is antithetical to people's thoughts about him, I'm sure.
Well, you know what? It makes sense to me. I mean, I've never read that, but it makes perfect sense because in order to be able to lose control, you have to feel safe and that things are set up so that you can lose control. So it makes perfect sense to me.
I think absolutely. Yeah. And he said, and you know, he's not completely against them. Sometimes they happen, but it's just like he wants the precision on set. Mm-hmm. He said, quote, I certainly think that there are happy accidents that can occur on set. And usually when that happens, I refer to it as the messiness of reality. And sometimes those accidents really make it into the movie. But for me, the joy is really when you have a target and you hit out an idea of where you can go and you want to hit that target and then you do. That's a kind of blissful moment of afterwards I go home and I say, thank you. And those moments don't always happen, but when they do, I would say that is the best feeling, you know.
Hmm.
He's still looking for that precision. But I like what you're saying about having that calm and peace on set, or like the order, and
you
then
have
you
to
get to go insane.
Absolutely. You've got to be safe. I mean, like in a fight sequence, you have to have everything choreographed and you have to make sure everything's safe so then you can actually go to that place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure other actors have a different process, you know.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that kind of grieving thing and how to put that onto screen. Because ugh. In this,
yeah,
you know,
wow.
Like there's a lot of grieving. And so Nicolas Cage was talking about, you know, how he kind of works up to it. He said, quote, it's a very hard thing to describe with words. It has more to do with memory and sound and kind of like a trance, really, where I know where I have to go. And I'll surf emotion throughout the day leading up to the moment of action just to see if it's there. Is it at my fingertips? Is it in my throat? Is it in my eyes? And bring it back. On other movies, I've written notes to myself and put them in my pocket. And the moment of action comes, out comes the note, and then I'll put it back in there, and there we go. But in that particular instance in Mandy, I don't know what I was thinking about or recalling in the bathroom, but it is not unlike going into some sort of other dimension and trying to pull up something from a well that's tucked away or buried in the earth somewhere. So he was doing kind of practical things in other movies, definitely, you know, like a note, a sad thing, a memory that he would recall and then putting in his pocket. And I mean, maybe he's gotten to the point in his career where it's just like, you can have an easier recall of, because he was talking very frankly about his life being, you know, in some ways a disappointment emotionally up at this time. And he felt that he had like a kind of well of emotion that he needed to get out anyway, and which is one of the reasons why he wanted to play Red.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, some actors are really facile with, when I say emotion, I'm referring to like tears, like that kind of.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
You know, and I've never been, it scares me. You know, there's all these, you know, you think about this, like you said, the thing in your pocket, a song, and, you know, there's the pressure of that you have to do it on cue, which
yes.
is, you know, then you're nervous and the nerves shut down your emotion. You know, it's not for me. It has never been easy, and it's always, it definitely comes from the idea that in your body. For me, it's more of the feeling, a song, as opposed to just, oh, I'm going to think about, you know, the time when my cat did. That just mm-hmm. is too in my head and too analytical.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, you know, there's the if you just start wailing, you do the sound of wailing, it triggers this emotion of, it triggers a body, mind, body of when you, like, you know how, like, you make yourself laugh?
Yeah.
And you start to laugh, and then all of a sudden things become fun. It's the same thing with. So you start that as opposed to starting. For me, it's interesting. I always connect more with. I first do what the body is like. I like to see what kind of shoes am I. I'm an outside in kind of more act than as opposed to like remembering things, because then I get too much into my head.
Yeah, and I mean that kind of stays true to everything that you're talking about in terms of just being in the body, you know, like knowing the body, feeling it, letting it guide that. I could potentially see that Nicolas Cage is in his kind of body in
Impressed. Incredibly impressed, because it was just such the most horrible thing to witness, and then just to be there alone in the bathroom just grieving. But it made perfect sense of like the stages of what he was doing. You know, he had to stay alive and cauterize his wounds. I mean, I thought that was really interesting. There was like the real practical mm-hmm. of like, I'm going to bleed to death if I don't do this. Not cauterize when I'm talking about, you know, antiseptic.
Sanitize.
So I love that, the sort of practical. So he wasn't there like, oh, I'm going to go to grieve. No, I'm going to go there because I need my, you know, stay alive. And then he starts drinking and then it all goes. And then that transformation, and he becomes this venging angel in his underpants.
Yeah.
Which that was fantastic. The lack of vanity.
Yeah.
That was something else that I really enjoy. But the lack of vanity in the film of all of the actors.
Mm-hmm. That they're okay with being a little bit, quote unquote, ugly.
Absolutely.
I mean,
looking like a real person.
Yeah. Not like a Hollywood movie, because this is not a Hollywood movie by any means.
That's right. Yeah.
What's the hardest piece of emotion that you've ever had to pull out when you've been working on screen?
You know, I'm just trying to think, have I ever done an emotional, the one on television, there was this one scene where I had to, my son was being taken away again. I was a crack addict, and, you know, of course, but there was this scene, you know, where I had to get up and just talk to him, and I knew where it should be, you know, and I would cry, you know, and that was, I was, oh my God, I'm going to blow it, you know, and mm-hmm. I mean, that's just my mind. Oh no, you know, it's, and, it was good. It worked. I mean, I did it, you know, I mean, that was the whole thing. You have your tricks and your things that you do so that you can be in the moment there. Mm-hmm. But that really was the only time. I mean, like with Titanic, the interesting thing was I couldn't cry.
Mm.
And all I wanted to do was cry.
Oh.
Because it was so sad. I mean, my thing was, it was to don't cry. I mean, a lot of times they'll tell you that in acting class, people don't try to cry. They try not to cry. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the whole thing. You don't, I'm going to cry now. You try not to, and it just comes out. So you're doing a counter, the counterpoint.
Yeah, you're working on multiple levels of emotion.
Always.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds pretty easy to me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and also I wanted to say, like, to get back to something else that you brought up that is a big thing, is you mentioned the wallpaper in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that in every scene and every shot, there is a meticulous attention to that kind of detail. And so something that might resonate with your time working on Aliens would be this, where Panos Cosmatos said, "I read a quote years ago, and I wish to God I could remember where it was or who said it, but it was basically along the lines of, it's as important what you don't show as what you do show. And for my very first super short film, I really always was kind of inspired by that, because by isolating a certain part of a room or an environment, you can make it feel like it extends a lot. Hmm. If you choose the right wall and the right frame, you can let the audience fill in the gaps in their mind, and it can make something seem a lot larger in scope than it actually is, literally."
Yes.
I thought that was lovely.
Really smart. I mean, I noticed that with the creatures, the
black skull.
The
gang.
Black skull gang. You never could see, you know, and I didn't, and you, yeah, you couldn't see them. You couldn't quite figure out what was their face and all of that. And the same thing with where the house that he was chained up in.
Yeah, their hideout gang. Yeah, the gang's hideout. I'm curious, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, too, because on the set of Aliens, like, you guys were building a world. And it had to look very populated by things, but it couldn't have been a huge set. It had to be pretty small. So it seems like he had to be isolating certain things and making it seem like it was bigger.
No, it was big.
It was?
Yeah. No, it was, well, the set of where the power station was, where we first go and we find the aliens, was an actual power station, a disused.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was Acton Power Station. It was a disused power station. I don't know what kind. And they built it into the set. So you were actually going up, you know, the creaky iron stair.
So it's almost like a haunted house that they built.
So you were walking into it. So, and the same thing when you were inside the ship and going down the tubes, you know, you were actually inside, you know, three-dimensional crawling down something. So it was, same thing for Titanic. I mean, you'd be like down a plank and down round corners, and the strangest thing was all of a sudden coming and looking at a camera. I was like, oh, you know.
Oh, I forgot we're on a movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you're always on a movie.
Yeah.
Someone's always filming you somewhere right now.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming and joining me today to talk about Mandy and to talk about your work and your bras.
My bras, right.
And people can find you where?
You mean the bras? Or
anything. Would they find you? They can find your bras.
The bras is JeanetteBras.com. And me, I'm just, I don't know, hanging around the local Trader Joe's.
Yeah, catch her if you can.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
They fucking loved it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.